We have, beginning here in Matthew, the 13th chapter, some warnings that Jesus gave regarding stumbling blocks. Here's the parable of the sower. And in verse number 22, we read, "He also that receives seed among the thorns is he that hears the word." So he receives it. He's not hostile and opposed to it. But what happens? "The care of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becometh unfruitful." So he is too heavily immersed in society and the world, and consequently does not produce what God says he should produce. We find a similar statement in Mark 4, verse number 19. Here's the one that is sown among the thorns, as we read in verse 18 and then in verse 19, "The cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the lust of other things entering in choke the word, and it becometh unfruitful." So we're talking here about riches, and we're talking about the deceitfulness of riches. And then in Luke 8, and verse number 14, "That which fell among the thorns are they which, when they have heard, go forth and are choked with the cares and the riches and the pleasures of this life, and bring no fruit to perfection." So what we're really seeing here is people who have received the knowledge of the truth in times past, well, any given time period in which that truth is made known, and then they allow that truth to be taken from them in such a manner they can't produce any fruit. They do not do what God says they should do. So I'd like to present some stumbling blocks today, and I'm going to start out with this one. This is not the only one, but this is probably a major one that gets in the way of people when they're first coming to a knowledge of the truth in particular, until they're very soundly established in the faith, and this is the love of money. The love of money. You know, being a Scotsman, when I first heard about tithes, that didn't set too well. It's like the three Scotsmen. I was like the three Scotsmen that were in church. And the plates started being trashed, and when I got close to them, the center one fainted, and the other two carried him out. Then I heard about second tithe. I didn't like that too well, and boy, a third tithe. So when it comes to money matters, when people are first converted, money is a very great concern and consideration. And some people, it is such a great concern and consideration, they never go any further than just the superficial knowledge, because money matters are too important in their lives. What does the Bible say about money? You know, people misquote the scripture all the time. They say money is the root of all evil. The Bible doesn't say that. It says the love of money is a root of all evils. Not money itself, but the love of it. Or someone then doesn't have a proper perspective with respect to it, and then consequently misses out on the calling that God intended him to receive. Now let's go to Matthew 13, verse number 22. Matthew 13, verse number 22. You see, I read this just a moment ago, but let's come back to it. "He also that receives seed among thorns is he that hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches." The deceitfulness of it. People put a lot of confidence in money, and particularly in the world in which we're living today, because most forms of money outside of just gold and silver coins are fiat forms of money, meaning they have no real intrinsic value in themselves. If somebody handed you, when I was a boy, I grew up in the state of Montana, I never saw a paper dollar till I was out of high school. They didn't exist. Every single dollar I ever saw up to that time was a silver dollar. We called them cartwheels. And when you would have a pocket full of them, it weighed down your pants. I remember my jeans would be sagging at times. I might have a dozen of those silver things in my pocket. My jeans would be sagging. Well, can you find a silver dollar nowadays? All you find is these little paper notes, you know, we pull them out, and it says a one or five or ten, whatever it is, on it, and down below it says Federal Reserve note. Now, it used to be that when you pulled out one of these little bills and you looked down at the bottom, it said silver certificate. That meant you could take that money in there and lay it down on the counter to a bank, and they were duty bound to give you silver coin in place of that paper dollar. But if you go in the bank now and it says Federal Reserve note, you can't get any silver coins. There's only one thing that keeps that money valuable, and that is confidence in it. It is deceitful. People can have their savings wiped out just overnight by what takes place by big money moguls back in the big merchant banks in the big cities of New York and so forth. It is deceitful. So people, they allow that deceitfulness to come in and destroy them. Now we come to Mark 4, verse number 19 once again, and let's emphasize a particular thing here. The cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches. That may involve a lot more than just money. That may involve possessions of one type or another, assets, all kinds of things that constitute one's wealth. And those things are considered deceitful too. And so we find that when people allow these things to enter in and begin to dominate their thinking, they become unfruitful in the eyes of God. Now, let's recognize this. When we're talking about money, we're talking about a relative thing. Now, let's go over once again here to Luke 8, verse number 14. We find here once again, they are choked with the cares and the riches and the pleasures of this life. The reason that people are so tied up and wrapped up in money is the things that money can buy. And so when we're talking about money, we're talking about things that involve the entire lifestyle and makeup of an individual who allows those things to get in the way. And it becomes a stumbling block. It can become a stumbling block. Now notice once again here, let's go over to Luke 21 now and verse number 34. Luke 21 and verse number 34. What's the warning given here? You better take heed to yourselves. See, when you live in an opulent society, we live in a consuming society here in America, so that we have actually developed a problem of ridding our country of our waste products. And it's so bad now, back in places on the East Coast, you know, they were dumping all of the city's garbage in trash ships and then hauling it out and dumping it in the ocean. And that became such a stink in the eyes of the environmentalists, they brought a halt to that. And now they have, for example, I remember when they have a dump, a huge dump over in Ohio there, and they haul truckloads of refuse and waste from big northern cities down there. It's a major problem because of the consuming society, all consuming society you have. And when we live in a society like that, we get used to these things. It's all relative. If you look at somebody that has $1 billion, somebody would think he's very wealthy. But I suppose if a man had $1 billion and he hobnobbed around with multi-billionaires who had several thousand billion dollars, whether anyone is that actually wealthy, I couldn't say for sure, but I mean, there are some of these people who are so wealthy we can't even imagine it. The man who has $1 billion wouldn't even seem wealthy. So it's a relative thing. So, you know, someone who's in the lower economic brackets can still allow money to be a stumbling block. It's just a matter of relativity and what he deems, what he regards as wealth. So that's why he warns here, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting. That is, just satiating the self. Now, how can you satiate the self unless you have the way and means to do it? Unless you're freeloading from someone else. I remember years ago when I was down in Missouri, there was a fellow that lived down on Lake Taneycomo, and he had a little motorboat, and we went down fishing one time on Lake Taneycomo, and when we came back from fishing, we sat in his house and had a meal, and I looked over to him and I said, you know what the Bible says? There's nothing better than to enjoy the fruits of your labor. It doesn't really say that, does it? It says enjoy the fruits of your own labor, but see, I was enjoying the fruits of his labor. So you'll find that people Some people are very adept at doing that, and they'll take advantage of others and live by that means. But most people who satiate themselves have the way and means to do it, because there's such an amount of money they possess. So it again illustrates that you be not overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and the cares of this life, so that this day come on you unawares. Luke 16, verse 13. You see, here's what the problem is. Money has to be put in its proper perspective. And if it becomes the all-consuming drive that someone has, then this is exactly what you read here in the scriptures. Luke 16, verse 13. No man can serve two masters. You see, you cannot serve God, and then you cannot serve, as it's going to say here, mammon, which just simply means wealth. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So that's why when I'm talking about a stumbling block, I'm saying the love of money, not money itself. And then it depends on how we use it and what use we put it to properly. You take the matter of tithing. God says he owns everything in the universe, and he gives us all the things we have. And he expects us to take a certain percentage of that, 10%, and to put it back so that it can be used to benefit other people. That's our tithe. It really belongs to God. He claims it. And when we refuse to pay tithes, or we mishandle our finances and our money, and we can't be responsible with that thing, in effect, God says you're robbing him, because you're robbing that portion which he says belongs to him. He gives you 10 tenths, and he expects you to hold on to 9, but to properly manage that 1/10. And yet there are people who love money so much that tithing will just be out of the question to them. I figured it out one time because there was a little chart that was listing the amount of contributions that are given by churches as a whole in this nation to their various denominations, and it came out like the average across the whole country was about 0.5% of the income of the country was being given to God. Can you imagine? Well, it's probably just as well when you understand so many false religions that exist in the world today, but can you imagine the time when it's going to be when there is a truth of God available and 10% of the national income is going to God? Well, what good could be done with that? So, as we read here in Luke 18, verse number 24, he said, "How hardly shall they that have riches enter into the kingdom of God?" It's because they set their heart on those riches. They don't use those riches properly. They do not use them to help other people. And remember, when this young man had all this wealth, what did Jesus say to him? He said, oh, he'd been doing all the commandments all of his life. He'd been living up to God's law as much as he understood it. And then Jesus said to him, now, we read here in verse 22, "Yet lackest thou one thing. Sell all that thou hast and distribute to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me." So Jesus was asking this young man to become one of his disciples and to have a tremendous responsibility in the future, but the young man declined. Because, see, his heart was set on these material possessions. So that's what can happen with it. 1 Timothy 6, verse number 9. "They that will be rich," you see, we're told previously here, "having food and raiment, let us be therewith content." I remember a young man who was a graduate from Ambassador College, and he got out into the workforce, and he made it known that he was going to be a millionaire by the time he was age 30. Well, I found out later he didn't end up being a millionaire by age 30. But that was his goal. Paul says, "Having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But they that will be rich," that is those who are determined to become rich, and that's their aim and goal, "they fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all evils." So that is one of the major stumbling blocks that we all face in this world. Most of us, I'm sure, have overcome that. But there are many people who haven't. That's why Paul says here in verse 17, "Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded." They get arrogant and puffed up because of the power that money grants them. And they can use money to do this and do that and have their way here and have their way there, and they misuse it. Tell them not to be high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches. You know, it's like in Germany prior to World War II in the 30s. They were trying to save the German economy, so the solution to the problem was just running off the printing presses. They had to have more money available. Well, what happens when you have an increase in the money supply and no commensurate increase in goods? You have more dollars competing for those goods, and as a result, prices go sky high. That's what inflation is. Blue sky money. In other words, they print the presses and run money off. You have huge sums of money, so the money loses its value, and you have to pay more and more for the same item. And so a German would go to bed at night, and he might own a house. Or he'd have enough money in his pocket to purchase a house the next day if he wanted to. The only problem is, by the time he woke up in the next morning, the money supply had been so inflated, that money would only buy him a sweater. That's what happened. It was things like that that set up Hitler, because he came along and promised he'd bring an end to that kind of thing. So it does demonstrate what happens was, as you read here, with uncertain riches. But in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. So one of the stumbling blocks we face in this life is this matter of handling our money and our finances properly. Being loyal in responsibility to God's law, so that we faithfully pay our tithes, and we recognize there is a responsibility in almsgiving too. If you start looking through the New Testament and you look up the word alms, you'll be surprised how many admonitions there are in the New Testament about giving alms. Now let's go to the second one I want to emphasize today, and that is creating God in some kind of an image to suit ourselves. Now how do we do that? Well, we're all familiar with the actual literal making of idols. That's how it was done in the ancient world, and probably to a certain extent is done in some portions of the world today. But I want to look beyond that, because that particular problem doesn't affect us. What affects us is when we hear God's instruction, or we hear the Bible, or we read something in the Bible, and then our response is, yeah, I know the Bible says that, but now this is the way I look at it. See, what we're doing is we are interpreting God to suit ourselves, and we create Him in our image, and we create what He says the way we think we would like Him to say. That's creating a God to suit ourselves. Now, when you look at all of the various mythological creatures that the Greeks invented, they weren't the first ones who started it by any means, but we are quite familiar with Greek mythology and the Greek gods, because the first historical records that we can really call Western history began around 700 BC. Prior to that time, the only record we have in the Western world is the Bible. But beginning around 700 BC, the Greeks began to write down their mythological gods and their history, and so we have quite a bit of knowledge about Greek gods. They had a god for everything. They had a god for wine. They had a god for love. They had a god for green. They had a god for war. They had a god for everything you can think of. They created these images in their minds, and then they made idols to conform to them. And so when Paul got up in Athens, you remember what he encountered there. Notice in Acts 17, verse 16. Now when Paul waited for them at Athens, he was waiting for his companions to arrive, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Idols everywhere. Then he saw this one dedication to an unknown God. So they even had a dedication to an unknown God. And then notice what Paul said here in verse number 22. Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, "You men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are, and we have here, too superstitious." That's not too good of a translation. It would be better to say, "You are extremely devout." He's not telling him that that devoutness is misguided at this point. In fact, if you go through his whole sermon here, it was a masterpiece. He leads them right on down the line, and then he shows them that the only real God, the one that they're calling the unknown God, is the true God. But did he convince everybody? Well, It says some believed, but others said, what's this scrap picker talking about? So it just demonstrates again how prevalent this sin of creating idols and images and making God in one's own image really is. And as Paul says here in verse 29, for as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think of the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. See, that's the way they did it, but each one of those gods represented a concept. They just took the concepts and they put them into a visual form so people can see them. You can have all kinds of concepts that you may follow that are contrary to God's will. They're not in some kind of a visible form you can see, but they're a part of your makeup and your thinking. It can be done very easily. Let's go back to Jeremiah chapter 2. Here's what God says about his people. Now, when I'm reading these texts here, just think in terms not only of literal images, because that was even prevalent back in the days of ancient Israel, and still is prevalent in some aspects of what we call Christianity today, and is very, very prevalent in many of the pagan religions that exist in the world today. But if you notice here in Jeremiah 2, verse number 11, has the nation changed their gods which are yet no gods? Do people do that? Not likely. That's rather unheard of. Because once a nation accepts a god, they will hang on to that god. Now, they may introduce new gods and bring those idols and those images in there, but they will still cling to that one god. And yet, as he says here, has a nation changed their gods which are yet no gods? Does that happen? Not likely. But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. They turn from God because God is invisible. They didn't have some kind of a physical representation they can look at, and they had this fixation in their mind somehow that in order to worship you had to have some kind of a visible image to look to. And that image represented something. So here was the people, here the nation of Israel did something that was practically unheard of. They turned from the true God and went off into idolatry. And of course, as you recall, the instigator of that in the large-scale development of it later on historically was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, as the Bible says, who caused Israel to sin. Now let's notice Psalm 106. Psalm 106 and verse number 20. You see, they made a calf in Horeb, as we read here in 19. Psalm 106, 19. And worshipped a molten image. Thus they changed their glory into the similitude of an ox that eats grass. They forgot God their Savior, which had done great things in Egypt. You know, it's just amazing. It's astounding when you stop back and think of those Israelites there when they had just come out of the land of Egypt. They had seen all the mighty acts and miracles of God. They had crossed the Red Sea. They had been given manna to eat. They had been provided water for themselves and for their cattle. To that quickly turn and begin to worship an idol. But I'll point something out here to you. This is very interesting. It's often overlooked. Let me get over here to this particular instance if I can find it. Where they began to worship, they made the golden calves. So I don't know where it actually is here, right offhand. Anyway, I can mention it to you. You remember when they came to Aaron and they insisted that he make this image? You read the next verse down, and what does it say? Tomorrow is a feast to Yahweh. So what'd they do? They changed Yahweh, or God, into this calf. That's how they wanted him represented. So it shows you how rapidly people can do that, and especially when you recognize that they had done it so quickly after leaving the land of Egypt and seeing all the miracles of God. 1 Corinthians 12, verse number 2. Here, Paul, when Paul was addressing the Gentile world, remember, he went up into Asia Minor and eventually into Greece and eventually into Rome. And there is quite a bit of traditional support that he was even in Spain and in the British Isles. But apart from that, in dealing with all of these Gentiles, what do you read here? This is what he tells him. You know that you were Gentiles carried away unto these dumb idols, even as you were led. Dumb idols, meaning idols that can't speak. But you see, as I pointed out earlier, all of those idols simply pointed to a concept. So this is what they were worshiping, various concepts of one type or another. 1 Peter 4, verse number 3. For the time past in our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lasciviousness. You know what they did with these idols and these images? They performed religious rites in front of them, and those religious rites many times were very obscene. That's how they worshipped. We walked in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries. That's what they were doing. Somehow or other, they felt if they could attach some obscene rite to a god, that gave them the right to practice that right in front of that god. That god, that idol somehow proved it. I suppose it wasn't a form of justification for their behavior. But in any respect, it does illustrate the problem that exists in the world where people constantly create gods to suit themselves. And if we'll notice here in Revelation 20, has this come to an end? At the very time of the end, when Christ returns, what do we read here? The rest of the men, Revelation 9, verse 20, the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. So people are going to continue in it. They're going to continue in that practice, and they're also going to continue in creating concepts of God they think applies in their particular case when there is no literal idol to worship. Those things will continue right on down to the time of the end. So I would just say one of the safest things you can do, realize, of course, that there are mistranslations in the Bible, and there needs to be, in many cases, a very close examination of the intended Greek or Hebrew, and that can be found out. But just make this a rule of thumb. What you read in the Bible, take it face value and believe it. That's the simplest. If God gave us His word, and we're to live by every word of God, let's take that word for what it says and believe it and practice it. That's the key. Now let's get to the third thing I want to point out today, and that is what I call misguided obsession with health. Misguided obsession with health. You know, every one of us has to be concerned about health, because after all, we are physical, flesh and blood human beings. But what the problem in the world today is that the entire approach for health and healing is misguided. Why? Because it almost entirely excludes God from the issue. Now, I have to remember a comment that Mark Twain once made. He said, if you want to be healthy, you can't eat the things you want, you can't drink the things you like, and you can't do the things you want to do. Pretty well describes it, doesn't it? You see, what people don't seem to realize is that health is directly related to one's lifestyle and how we eat, what our frame of mind is, and things such as that. So that there are seven laws of health. One of the primary laws of good health is avoiding those meats which God says are not fit for human consumption because they're unclean. They're not suitable for man's well-being. Oh, they taste good. Oh, boy, do they taste good. Well, I can remember when I was a boy, you know, we never saw oysters where I lived until Christmas time, and then the grocery stores would get a big shipment of oysters in. There they were, those big old raw oysters. Man, I'd run down there and I'd buy a bunch of those oysters, and boy, I'd just gulp them down raw. Every once in a while, my mother would say, son, do you want some pickles pig feet today? Yeah, I'd like some pickles pig feet. In our senior banquet in high school, I'll never forget this. It was a great big ham, and I was sitting next to the superintendent's wife, a very lovely lady. And I was talking to her, and I reached over and grabbed a piece of that ham, and I kept talking away, and I got my fork on the plate, and I looked, and I didn't have any ham on my plate. It was out in the middle of the table. and fallen off my fork onto the table. I was so embarrassed. Great big round slice of delicious ham. Oh, it tastes good, sure, doesn't it? God says, don't eat it. It was not intended for human consumption. That's one of the laws of health. How many of you have ever heard of that from a medical doctor? Once in a while, a medical doctor is wise enough to say, don't eat pork because it's got too much fat in it. And you look at the problem we have with beef today, and it's been bred in such a manner that there's marble all through the meat, and it's very difficult to get beef that doesn't have a lot of fat in it. That's one of the reasons that there's a big comeback beginning to occur on Texas longhorns. And if you go down driving through Texas, you'll be surprised. You look out in the fields there, and you'll see herds of longhorns. Why do they want longhorns? Because the meat doesn't have any of the marble in it. They've just bred this beef up to such an extent it's just full of fat. The Bible says, do not eat the fat or the blood. Then we have, of course, the new HMOs and the whole ball of wax regarding health issues and health problems where God is not taken into consideration. Now, in the 21st century, you know, that's just about ready to roll over on us here, 9 out of 10 persons, in other words, 9 out of every 10 people will die of some kind of disease. Only 1 out of 10 will die a natural death. Half of them will die either from heart attack or strokes. That's 5 of them. 3 or more of those will die of cancer. And most of the rest will die from complications of diabetes, asthma, arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, AIDS, and etc. This is the health problem we have in the nation and probably in the world. So we do need to recognize that a misguided obsession with health is not really serving any really worthwhile purpose. And it is something we ought to be aware of. Notice 3 John verse 2. And I might point out that it isn't just a diet that is a major cause of health. Well, it certainly is. A major cause of health is diet. When you consider not only meat, but you consider all the various other foods that have been vitiated and sullied and ruined and the real food value taken out of them, so we're just eating empty carbohydrates. But in addition to that, environmental and industrial pollution. It used to be far worse than what it is, but, you know, there are governmental agencies that are clamping down on negligence on the part of manufacturers in exposing their workers to industrial pollution, and there have been many people who've died as a result of it. But we do need to realize, as John said here, 3 John verse number 2, Beloved, I wish above all things that thou may prosper and be in health. So under the inspiration of God's Spirit, it certainly shows here that it is God's desire that we have good health. But we don't always have it, all of us. And it seems like sooner or later, as we grow older, we develop things that are not really good for us. Most of you young people, you know, you never think about being very cautious and careful about what you put in your stomach. Because you can put about anything in your stomach and get away with it for the time being. But I'll guarantee you, when you start reaching middle age, you will have to change because you will find your body will not handle those things. I used to just love coffee. Oh, I would get these dark Colombian Supreme beans and then I would put them in a grinder and put it in one of these filters, pour boiling water over it, and then fill it with half cream, and I'd drink 10, 15 of those a day. They'd see me come skipping in the office and they knew I'd had my coffee. Well, I tell you, I got to the place where I can't drink coffee. I cannot touch it. Well, I can touch it very, very sparingly. So you find out when you get older, your body and your system will not take what you have been putting into it. And you will have to change your lifestyle. But you go back here to Jeremiah, the 17th chapter, and notice what we read here. See, God gives us this instruction to prevent these things, and God certainly claims his responsibility as the God healer. But as we read here in Jeremiah 17, verse 5, cursed is the man that trusts in man. We have it written in our healing article, I think there's 4,000 diseases that affect men, and only 2,000 of those are curable. 2,000 of them are not curable. And yet people will just somehow seem to think that the doctors have all the answers. Doctors don't have all the answers. That's why it says here, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Lord. Because they don't take God in consideration in the matter of health. Jeremiah 8, verse number 22. Is there no balm in Gilead? In other words, is there no healing balm here for you? Is there no physician there? Keep in mind that physicians back in those days were not the kind of physicians we have today. They were more naturopaths and dealt with natural things more than what the modern medical profession deals in, which is essentially chemical. But anyway, what does it say? In other words, who was the real healer and who was the physician? Yahweh Rofeka, the God healer. He was their God. He's saying, why have you abandoned me? That's why it says, why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? They weren't looking to God even in that day, many of them. Here was a king, one example here. And this man was essentially a good king. 2 Chronicles 16, verse number 12. We read here, Asa in the 39th year of his reign was diseased in his feet. 2 Chronicles 16, 12. Until his disease was exceeding great. We don't know what it was. I'm sure they didn't really know what it was either. It might have been some form of diabetes. It might have been gout. It might have been a circulation problem that led to this condition where the body just swells and then dies. And what they do nowadays is they end up cutting it off. We don't know what it was, but what happens? Yet in his disease he sought not to the Lord, but to the physicians. Gangrene, that's what I was thinking of, turns into gangrene. And what was the consequence of it? And Asa slept with his fathers and died in the 140th year of his reign. So he lived just 3 years after that, and he sought to the physicians instead of God. Now, if he would have sought to God, God would have healed him. We have examples of that, of these kings. Mark 5, verse number 26. Here was the lady that had this issue of blood, as it says here. A certain woman which had an issue of blood 12 years and had suffered many things of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was nothing bettered, but rather grew worse. I don't know of a single doctor. I've never heard of one. Maybe some of you have heard of one, and if you have, please tell me. I've never known a doctor yet that said, you come into my office, and if you're not healed by my treatment, I'll give you your money back. Have you ever heard one say that? See, they can't guarantee anything. So it does demonstrate, in this particular case here, this woman just became more broke and more broke. And she came to Jesus. Well, and it was amazing what happened to her. She just thought, if I can just touch him, I'll be healed. And she touched him and she was healed. But he immediately knew it, as we read here. She touched him. She had, straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, as we read in verse 29, and she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that virtue or power had gone out from him, turned about in the press and said, who touched my clothes? And his disciples said to him, thou seest the multitude thronging thee, and sayest thou, who touches your clothes? So then the woman came. She fell down in front of him. He said, your faith has made you whole. Oh, would to God we all had faith like that today. Wouldn't that be wonderful? So we can see here that certainly many people have a misguided obsession, a misguided direction in it, and it has presented a stumbling block to many people. Here in Exodus 15 chapter. Exodus 15, verse number 26. This is what God claims. This is one of his titles. If you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God and will do that which is right in his sight and will give ear to his commandments and keep all the statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee which I have brought upon the Egyptians. I read several books a number of years ago on paleopathology. That is, the examination of mummies by x-rays and by other methods to determine what diseases these mummies had. And you know what they found in these mummies? They found every single modern disease that we have today. Every one of them. You know, we think that dental treatment is new. They found mummies with fillings. So they suffer from tooth decay just like we do. He said, I won't put any of these diseases on you, as we read here in the latter part of this verse here. I am the Lord that healeth thee. And that is an actual title in the Hebrew. It is Yahweh Rofeka, meaning I am your God healer. That's his title. That's what he claims. And yet, I suppose if you went to any doctor's office today and you sat there among the patients and you asked any of those patients, how many of them knew that God heals? How many would raise their hands and say, oh, I know God heals? Very, very few. 2 Kings 20, verse number 3. Here was Hezekiah. We read in verse 1, in those days was Hezekiah sick unto death. So he had some fatal disease. And we read here, he was told by Isaiah, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live. Then he turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord. You ought to read that prayer sometime. It's really a heartfelt prayer. He poured out his soul to God, and notice what happened. It came to pass before Isaiah was gone out into the middle court. Verse 5, the word of the Lord came to him saying, turn again and tell Hezekiah, the captain of my people, thus saith the Lord, the God of David thy father, I have heard thy prayer, I have seen thy tears. Behold, I will heal thee. That's the proper orientation. So this is what we need to realize. Whenever it comes to the matter of health and well-being, there are two things we want to look at. You young people, this is the time to begin. Don't wait till you're old and then you're suffering from some of the things we suffer from. Start on it now. That's preventative medicine, if I can use that term. In other words, preventative maintenance of your body so that you see to it that you become aware of the good health measures and you learn to abide by them. And you stop pouring all this junk food down your system. Oh, it tastes good. You can get it real quick. But it is not good for you. I forget the actual figures I read here a while back, but the amount of fat that's in junk food is just prodigious. Far more than normal foods. Yet how many of us go in and we'll buy these junk food and these burgers and these French fries and all these things, and boy, they taste good. I know they taste good. You keep that long enough and you will pay the price. So we have the matter of preventative, taking preventative measures to keep good health, and then we also need to realize that God is very much in the picture when it comes to the matter of healing. Let's not be misguided in our efforts. Philippians 2 and verse number 27. Here he's talking about Epaphroditus, one of God's assistants, Paul's assistants, and it says, indeed he was nigh sick unto death. But God had mercy on him, and not him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. So God was merciful and healed this young man. And he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He'll do the same thing for us. So let's keep these things in mind. Now, the last point I want to cover with on the matter of these stumbling blocks is one that certainly affected most of us at one time in the past when we were first being introduced to the truth, and that is overly concerned with other people. Overly concerned with other people. I first started receiving the Plain Truth magazine when I was in the Army in 1952. I ordered the Plain Truth and the Good News magazine, and it came down to the mail room, and I went to the mail room one day and I asked for it. And I'll never forget this. It was so embarrassing to me. At that time it was. Here was this magazine. It said right on the front, big bold letters, did angels marry before the flood? And I asked the sergeant there for my mail, and he said, yeah. He looked at me, he said, yeah, you got some kind of a wacky religious thing. And I hit it. overly concerned about people, aren't we? Well, that's another stumbling block, and it certainly can be one that is dangerous. Let's notice here John 12, verse number 43. John 12, verse 43. Here he's talking about the problem that existed among the religious leaders of that day, and he said, "Nevertheless, among the chief rulers also many believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God." That's a very bad stumbling block. That's something we all need to be on guard for. I don't say by that that we should go to the other extreme and flaunt our religion and go around bragging about it, but I can tell you neither should we be ashamed of it. It's like my youngest son. He wanted off his job to keep the Day of Atonement. And the boss said to him, "Well, is it on the calendar?" He said, "Yeah, here it is, Yom Kippur. It's called Yom Kippur." Well, he said, "What's Yom Kippur?" He said, "Well," he started telling him about, "we fast on that day and we go to church service." The boss said, "That's enough, that's all right." He didn't want to hear anymore. But he got the day off all right. So we have to realize that we certainly should not be ashamed of the truth. John 5, verse number 44. "How can you believe which receive honor one of another and seek not the honor that cometh from God only?" Luke 16, verse 15. Luke 16, verse 15. He said, "You are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God." So the very thing that people are trying to protect, their image, and they want to look good in the sight of other men, God says is an abomination. Those things that are esteemed by men. Matthew 6, verse number 2. Matthew 6, verse 2. Again, here's an example of a type of a show-off. We've heard about almsgiving. "Therefore, when you do your alms, do not sound the trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward." So you see, when people do things for a show, to show off to others, it's the same thing. It's overly concerned with men and what men think. Matthew 23, verse number 5. "All their works they do to be seen of men." Talking about these Pharisees and their behavior and their conduct. 2 Corinthians 10, verse number 18. 2 Corinthians 10, verse number 18. "Not he that commends himself is approved." This is what people do. They go around commending themselves. That doesn't count, God says. What counts is whom the Lord commends. And that may not even be known until the resurrection. But if one has faith in God and continues faithfully in the truth, he's not going to be worrying about the approval that he may receive of men at this particular time. Luke 14, verse number 26. "If any man come to me," and we have the word "hate not," that's a very poor translation. It means to love less by comparison. It's a comparative verb here. "If any man come to me and does not love less by comparison, his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." So how many people put their relatives and their family members ahead of God? I know that there were people. I knew people back in 1974 and 75 when the church came unglued and came apart there, and they knew things were wrong. They admitted they were wrong, and they knew that the church was going off into error, but they wouldn't leave. You know why? Because they had relatives and friends in there, and they didn't want to leave those friends. They didn't put God first. And this is a typical example. The text I just read to you explains it. And then in Matthew 10, verse number 37, "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." So this is what we're seeing now about this overly concern. So let me just summarize in saying there are stumbling blocks out there we all need to be on guard for. One of them certainly involves the love of money and not having a proper insight and perspective as to how to handle it wisely, creating gods to suit ourselves, to justify what we do, and interpreting the word the way we like to so we can continue on what we're doing, and having a misguided direction in health so that we do not take God into consideration both in the preventment and in the help we need for healing. And then, of course, lastly, this over-concern with people. These are stumbling blocks we all should try to avoid.